Today, see on themes, Book of the Fives and Guttara Nikaya, number 57. It's actually quite a popular one, and Ajahn Brahmali likes to use it when he's teaching a meditation retreat. I don't need to teach a class, you just look at the screen. I could just sit here quietly. That would be wonderful. Anywho. Is it up? Well, anyways, one of the reasons why I chose this sutta is because I think it's quite a practical one, and is very useful for a person who is, you know, a Buddhist and who wants to find some sort of motivation to, you know, to push themselves along this path. And it's basically reflections on your, you know, old age, sickness and death. And also things which are beloved and dear to you, you'll be separated from them one day. And also on karma. So I think it's quite a simple one, but it's very powerful. And is it up? Five. Yeah. Yeah, 57. Anyway, it's a very simple sutta about simple things. But when you think about it, it is very true. And sometimes with such subjects like this, we tend to forget about them because they're not like the lofty teachings of the Buddha, you know, things like dependent origination, the jhanas, the enlightenment. This is something which is, you know, in a sense quite mundane compared to those things, but at the same time they're very powerful because these are the things that the Buddha saw before he became a monk. He saw a person who was old, saw a person who was dying, he saw a dead person, and before that he lived a life in luxury. His father protected him from seeing anything like that. He lived in palaces where, you know, they said that the sun didn't even touch his skin. And he was entertained all day by musicians. And he ate the best food and he had the best education. His dad actually didn't want to expose him to the reality of life. And this is what the sutta is about. It's about the reality of life. Things that happen around us all the time, but we just don't want to see it. Because it's challenging. And in a sense, we are in denial. We don't want to see these things. We don't want to accept them. And because when they start happening to us, we suffer. Because we haven't, you know, trained our minds or reflected upon such things, you know, developing the wisdom that comes from understanding our bodies. Is it up now? Okay. Okay, so we can start. Just to let you know, I'm not a scholar, I'm more of a builder, so hopefully I don't take a sledgehammer to this sutta and wreck it. Calm down. All right, okay. Okay, here we go. Bhikkhus. So he was talking to the monks. There are these five themes that should be often reflected upon by a woman or a man, by a householder, or one gone forth. So this is for everybody, this sutta, for monks, nuns and lay people. What five? A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus: I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect: I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus: I am subject to death. I am not exempt from death. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus: I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. A woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus: I am the owner of my karma, the heir of my karma. I have karma as my origin, karma as my relative, karma as my resort. I will be the heir of whatever karma, good or bad, that I do. So the Buddha is telling us here that we should try to reflect upon these things time and time again. And, you know, when I was a young monk, when I heard teachings like this, I thought, oh, they're not very important. Because I'm young, I'm not sick. And, you know, sometimes these thoughts don't come across my mind. But over the years, you start thinking about these things, and you can see how powerful they are. Then, you know, teachings like this do become important. And I'll get to that later on, how these teachings do benefit us in terms of getting ourselves to, you know, refocus on the reason why we live our lives. Okay. For the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus: I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. In their youth, beings are intoxicated with their youth, and when they are intoxicated with their youth, they engage in misconduct by body, speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with youth is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus: I am subject to old age. I am not exempt from old age. So this is the part where the Buddha talks about the reason why we reflect upon these things. So here he's talking about old age. And when we think about old age, it tells us that we have a limited of time on this earth. And in a sense, if you think about it time and time again, that limitation in time, you can only do so many things. So what the Buddha is, what I get from it is, in life we have to set our priorities, you know, what to do, things which are important. And he goes on and says that, you know, you get intoxicated with your youth. That means you're young, yeah. You got your university degree, you got your money, you can go out surfing, you can have partners, you can do this, you can do that, you can really enjoy your life. But as you all know, time passes by really quickly. And before you know it, you're like 38. That's me. And then you're 40, and then you turn 50, and then you think to yourself, oh, what have I done with my time? Have I wasted it? Or have I used it well? So, So then the Buddha goes on and says that but when somebody reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with youth is either completely abandoned or diminished. That's very important as well. Because it tells us that what's happening to this person is that they are weakening. Like it says diminished in this book, but in the original Anguttara Nikaya, it uses the word weakening. Weakening. So what happens is you start to look at the limitations that youth can give you. And yes, we live in a world where there is happiness of the, you know, of the body, of the mind. But at the same time, there is suffering as well. But at the same time, you have a teaching like the Dhamma, a way out, a practice. And this is a path that, you know, each and every one of us can pursue and walk on. But what he's saying here, when these things become diminished, is you start to see the limitations. So what happens is the attachments, you know, the cravings, they get weakened, or you see that there's no point doing these things. And once you can, in a sense, release yourself from the things that you can get into when you're young, then you can have more time to prioritize and do what is important. And this is the Buddha's teachings, this is the Dhamma. So what's important is the practice. Okay, any questions? Yes.
Seems quite lofty, like.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. Abandon. My interpretation of that is you get to a point where, you know, you get really deep meditation and you can like completely let go. It's like a loftier state. But then when you look at the word diminished, you can understand that if you've been a Buddhist for a long time, you can see your attachments becoming diminished over the years. It's as if, you know, they were strong a few years ago, but now they're getting weaker and weaker and weaker. And then eventually they will diminish or abandon, got rid of, yeah. Like, I don't know what people's interpretations are, but when it comes to like letting go and giving up things, I don't think it all happens at once. Like one day you're full of craving, full of ill will, full of delusion, and then the next day you don't have it anymore because you had some sort of experience. I don't think it works that way. It's more of a training, you know, step by step. Like the period, you can sort of see it as Nirvana being a pyramid being built by bricks. So you just built brick by brick by brick until you get to the peak, and that's Nirvana. It just comes in stages, you know, step by step. And in the same way, when it comes to like letting go of things completely, you do it in stages. That's why when you see, that's why when you all remember me many years ago, I was full of defilements, and now I'm still full of defilements. But they've become weakened over time. And you all know that as well. You've been practicing for a long time, and you can see yourself becoming more calmer and more peaceful, yeah. Another interesting thing about old age, I was flicking through the suttas, and the Buddha said that when the body becomes old, it becomes, I don't want to put the old people give no hope to the old people, but the body becomes a little bit more tighter, a little bit more weaker. You know, it's 1 o'clock in the afternoon and you want to go to bed, and you slept 12 hours and you wake up and you're still tired. And the Buddha said, like, being old, I didn't say this is what the Buddha said, so please don't hate me. The Buddha said being old is like almost like a hindrance. It makes it difficult for one to strive on the path. Okay, so we're number two. This is a really good mic, isn't it? It's a good mic. What brand is it? Okay. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder, one gone forth, often reflect thus, I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. In a state of health, beings are intoxicated with their health, and when they are intoxicated with their health, they are engaged in misconduct of body, by body, speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with health is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder, one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I am subject to illness. I am not exempt from illness. Again, we're not going to be healthy and strong for the whole of our lives. And the body, the Buddha said they engage in misconduct of body, speech and mind. And sometimes when I look at that, I like to look at it in a way where it takes you away from the practice of the Dhamma, really. Like getting involved with things that you can waste time on. And misconduct. Misconduct can mean a lot of things. It could mean like making bad karma with your body, with your speech, saying the wrong things, and also with your mind. But I think when this sutta is about focusing on the path and trying to come to a point of liberation, and as you can see, there's a duality in these paragraphs. There's one side of it is the unwholesome, yeah, misconduct by body, speech and mind, and the other side is the wholesome, the abandoning and or diminishing of the intoxication with health. So it just makes you yet again reflect upon your well-being, upon your health. And the Buddha also said in one of the other suttas is that if you're a person who is sickly, with like a bad digestion, who isn't healthy, he said that is also a hindrance for you to strive on this path. So I think you can connect those two suttas together and get more meaning of what the Buddha is trying to say here. And as a practitioner for some years, you get to understand that when you're sick or when you have a cold or a stomach ache, it just makes it that much more difficult to meditate. It becomes more of a hindrance. And when you are healthy and you're strong, then when it comes to meditate, the body is more energetic, it's more sharp, so the practice becomes a lot easier. And misconduct by body, speech and mind, in a sense, it's how we live our lives, what we do when we're healthy. Do we live a virtuous lifestyle, or do we not? You know what I mean? This is what the Buddha could be pointing to as well. And that's, I think that's one of the things that I like about the Buddha's teachings. It's not so detailed. He just makes a few points. And for each and every one of us, we can have our interpretation in, you know, what he's saying. It's like that simple teaching outside. He says, do wholesome things. Wholesome thing, let go of unwholesome things and purify the mind. It's very simple, but in a sense I think it's quite good, because everybody sees the world differently. Everybody interprets the meaning, the words differently. And even when I look at this, I'm giving you my own spin and my own interpretation. And if Ajahn Brahm was here, he would give his spin, Ajahn Bhamali or whoever, you know what? Yeah. And okay, we go to number three. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, often reflect thus: I am subject to death, I am not exempt from death. During their lives, beings are intoxicated with life, and when they are intoxicated with life, they engage in misconduct by body and speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, the intoxication with life is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder, one gone forth, should often reflect thus: I am subject to death, I am not exempt from death. Yeah, so death is a scary thing for a lot of us. And I think when one starts to contemplate one's death, one can start to accept their, you know, fate. And yes, it's just like basically the same thing that I've been saying before. If one doesn't think about these things, one can get carried away in the world, just wasting time, pretty much. All of you come here with, you know, really good intentions. Some of you want to become monks, some of you don't. And just thinking about that, this life is, you only have a certain time to it. What the Buddha is trying to say here is to use it wisely and to reflect and think about it. Think about life. And he gave us, you know, these teachings as a format for us to follow. And he's saying to us not to waste our time. You know, we're going to die soon. Don't go out and make bad karma. In a way, we live in a very harmonious country in Australia. We're governed very well. There's no wars. There's no poverty. So in a sense, we don't need to, we don't need to go out there and create, you know, bad karma. You know, if you see, if you say you're living in a place where there's a lot of poverty, you're more encouraged to go out there and steal to survive. Or you're living in a place where there's wars, and because you have to protect yourself or protect your family, then you get pick up a gun or whatever, and you try to protect yourself. There's violence there. So, in a sense, living in Australia, we are very fortunate because we're living in a very harmonious place, and it's quite difficult for us to engage in misconduct of the body, speech and mind when it comes to such things. But yet again, it's always good to reflect upon it. Because, you know, we are going to die. And where are we going to get reborn? We're lucky enough to come across Dhammaloka Center and the monks that teach here and the bhikkhunis as well. But what's going to happen in our next lives? If you live a life where there's misconduct in body, speech and mind, when you die, do you think in your next life will you be able to come into contact with such teachings? But if you live a good life, making good karma, practicing, you don't need to become monks, but the intention of being one, to eventually one day, you know, end suffering, to experience, you know, full peace, freedom and enlightenment. If you have that in your hearts when you pass away, you never know. You might come back. Dhammaloka could still be here. And there'll be, Ajahn Brahm probably won't be here, but you never know. The suttas will. His talks will. Photos of him on the wall. There might be pictures of him on the wall. So yeah, it's a very powerful, these are very powerful contemplations. We get sick. You know, we get lost in our youth. Oh, I'm 20 years old. I won't make any good karma today. I'll just wait until tomorrow. You know that old saying, oh, I'm really young. I'm not going to meditate today. I'll meditate tomorrow. And then tomorrow becomes what? 1 week? 2 weeks? And then before you know it, you're like 50 or 60 years old. And then you're like, oh, I'm too tired now. I don't have enough strength. Oh, what am I going to do? So yeah, these are very good reflections. Very good. Okay. Number 5. As for the sake of, and for the sake of what benefit, should a woman or a man, a household or one gone forth, often reflect thus, I am the owner of my karma. The heir of my karma. I have karma as my origin, karma as my relative, karma as my resort. I will be the heir of whatever karma, good or bad, that I do. People engage in misconduct of the body, speech and mind, but when one often reflects upon this theme, such misconduct is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a household or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I am the owner of my karma, the heir of my karma, I have karma as my origin, karma as my relative, karma as my resort. I will be the heir to whatever karma, good or bad, that I do. So yeah, the Buddha's asking us to turn our minds to this thing that we call karma, which is, you could say, a popular word in our culture today. You know, people use it all the time. They go, oh yeah, it's karma, that's why it's happened to them. But the Buddha is telling us to just think about it. The idea of being a good person, of making good karma. I remember when I was, before I became a Buddhist, I didn't have that concept. Oh, you know, making good karma. I guess I was a good person. I was a good enough person. But just the idea of actively doing something good, it wasn't in my mind until I came across this teaching. And then I started to, you know, actively do stuff, like, you know, spend more time with my mother, be kinder to my brother, you know, and things like that. You know, taking my mates out and, you know, buying them lunch or dinner. You know, these teachings make us think about how we can use our resources in a different way. And the idea of karma is, he says here, you're the owner of your karma. So whatever you do, you own it. If you make good karma, you own that. If you make bad karma, you own that. So in a way, you can't really get away with anything. And sometimes when we live a life, this life, and we find ourselves in situations where, whether it's work or whether it's our family, and we get into arguments and we get into fights, and you know, we can't let go, we want to take revenge on that person. Sometimes it's just good to just use this teaching on karma and just say, oh, okay, if that person is treating me like crap, then I don't have to teach him a lesson. I'll just step back and just think to myself that their karma is what they're doing is they're making bad karma, and that is the cause for their suffering. They're not in a good headspace. So there's no need for you to like correct them or take revenge or you know, be defiant when somebody has done something wrong to you. Because you all know if you start retaliating and trying to win the battle, it never ends. You just walk around and your mind is, you know, encompassed with these, you know, bad thoughts and feelings. So I have karma as my origin, karma as my relative, karma as my resort. So yeah, like karma is like quite a personal thing for us. Is, you know, whatever we do, it's, you know, it sticks to us. It's very close to us, like our relatives, our resort. You know, at the end of the day, we go back home, and all we're left with is not. You know, we go back home. So you're from the office, you go back home, and you're by yourself, and you're with yourself. And what else are you with? You know, you with your karma, the karma that you made that day. So I will be the heir of whatever karma, good or bad, that I do. So, you know, what goes around comes around. People who engage in misconduct by body and speech and mind, that, you know, that speaks for itself. And for the sake, after, you know, after contemplating this for many, many a times, you start to abandon unwholesome karma and just try to generate wholesome karma.
Yes.
Okay. Now it changes a bit. Huh? Oh, I missed a part, didn't I? Number four. Okay.
What time is it?
Any questions? No. Yes, Eddie?
Ajahn Santuti.
Oh.
I think this sutta,
yeah.
The gist of this sutta is, you know, life is reflecting on the, you know, what old age, sick, illness and death, okay? Is that life is short, you see, okay? And when it, like, don't waste our time, you know?
Yeah.
Because there's a karma involved, you know? As I see, okay? The first part, just to reflect on old, sickness, old age and death, so that's depressing to want to contemplate on even that, you know.
Yeah.
So when karma was brought in, oh, it makes sense.
Okay, yeah.
You see what I mean? I see it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So like within this short period of time, we have this thing, don't waste our time because you are subject to future rebirth too, based on
our
karma.
Yeah, that's right, yeah. Our time is limited. So we've got to use our time wisely on this earth. And I think the human potential is like amazing what you can do with the mind. I mean, humans built this hall. We made cars, invented light. Our mind is so, you know, powerful in a sense. So if we really wanted to, we can make something good, you know, of our lives. Make some sort of impact to better the world. Okay. Okay, number four. And for the sake of what benefit should a woman or a man, a household or one going forth, often reflect us. I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. Beings have desire and lust in regard to those people and things that are dear and agreeable. And excited by this lust, they engage in misconduct by body and speech and mind. But when one often reflects upon this theme, the desire and lust in regard to everyone and everything dear and agreeable is either completely abandoned or diminished. It is for the sake of this benefit that a woman or a man, a householder or one gone forth, should often reflect thus, I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. And what really stands out is, for me in this paragraph is, I must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable to me. And it's just, I think what he's talking about here is the basic attachments that we develop through our lives with the people who are really close to us. And the Buddha here is giving us a way to have perspective when a close one is separated from us. You know, if, people in this room, I'm sure some of you have had somebody who's really close to you that has passed away or has been taken away. And how much, you know, suffering has that given you? So, you know, he said, when you contemplate that things are parted from separated, must be parted and separated from you, he said, if you contemplate that often, like these things, like completely abandoned or diminish. Like the attachment, you know, lust is in this context like lust or, you know, craving for like the opposite sex. But I also think the attachment that you have to a loved one. And you can, and this gives people perspective, it gives them something to think about, that there comes a time where, you know, our mum or our fathers, our friends, good friends, they pass away. If you're a person who doesn't reflect upon the fact that these things can happen, when it does happen, the suffering can be immense. It could be numbing, it could be paralyzing. But because you have this perspective, you have this understanding that people are not going to be here forever. So when they go, yes, you are going to suffer. You are going to suffer. But at the same time, you have the teachings of the Buddha to help you, like, lessen that suffering, to give you perspective, to give you the understanding that this happens to everybody, not just only me. And I think the problem comes from when people start taking it too personal. Why is it happening to me? It's unfair. And that just adds more difficulty and more, you know, sorrow to the situation. And you can see, it's very sad to see things like this happening. I remember when, so one of our supporters, her son died, right? Her son died, and obviously, you know, she's a Buddhist, so she has this understanding that not everybody's going to live until an old age. Accidents happen. People can die at any time. So you can see when it happened that she was devastated, she was hurt by it. But over time, because she had perspective, she got over, you know, the sorrow and pain. But on the other hand, you know, her husband, he couldn't accept it. I think he was blaming himself. And you could see that he wasn't able to forgive himself or to get perspective, to get some understanding. So each day that went past without his son being there, you could see the suffering getting more and more and more. And then, before you know it, a couple of years later, the husband passed away. And he wasn't, like, old. But I thought about it. I didn't ask questions, but it was kind of obvious. Each time I saw him, when he went to the monastery, he just looked more depressed, more despondent. Something tragic like this has happened to his life. Now he has nothing to live for. And because of that, that suffering, you know, sort of like he died from a broken heart, as people would say. And I would have, and sometimes, you know, we just have little discussions in the monastery, and I always talk to Ajahn Bhumali, and I go, Ajahn Bhumali, well, you know, what's the point of thinking about rebirth and, you know, contemplating this and that? You know, when someone dies who is really close to us, we're going to suffer. You know, that's the nature of life. But then he said, yes, you are going to suffer, but with these principles and with these teachings, it gives you perspective. So in a way, it will help you lessen the suffering because you have more understanding in the nature of life. And the famous story about the Buddha with the lady and the baby, she was suffering a lot. The Buddha told her to go around to the houses and collect a mustard seed from a house which hasn't had anybody who has died there. So she went to this house and asked the person or the person living, has anybody died here? And she said, yes, my grandfather. And she went to the next house and asked the same question. She went to many, many houses, and all the answers that she got was that somebody has passed away. So she could never collect that mustard seed. So the Buddha said, did the Buddha say if you collect that mustard seed, I'll bring your baby back to life? I can't remember. Anyway, so, and then the penny dropped. Because she was just focusing on herself. Why is this happening to me? My whole world is crumbling down. But then she got perspective. It's not only me, it's everybody. This is the nature of life. And once she understood that, the suffering started to lessen. She could eventually forget about it and move on. Did she become a nun? Become enlightened, I think, or something like that. Well, anyways, yeah. It's good enough, yeah? Okay. Okay, so we're going to... So I messed up a bit there, so we're going to skip number 5 and go to number 1 again. Yeah? This noble disciple reflects thus, I am not the only one who is subject to old age, not exempt from old age. All beings that come and go, that pass away, undergo rebirth, are subject to old age. None are exempt from old age. As he often reflects on this theme, the path is generated. He pursues this path, develops it, cultivates it, and as he does so, the fetters are entirely abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. So the noble disciple. What does Ajahn Bhumali say about the noble disciple? Does anybody know? Huh? Minimum string winners. Or on the path. So, yeah. So that's like people on the path to becoming stream enterers or stream enterers themselves. But I think you can look at this part and, you know, you can still use it for your own practice, because it goes on and says that, you know, everybody has to get old, and then you think about getting old and you think about life and you think about where you want to achieve and where you want to go, and because you're interested in Buddhism, you understand that you're going to get old one day, so now that you're young, fit and healthy, you might as well just try to develop this path and cultivate it so that the fetters are abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. So it allows us to just create more focus, put our minds on the path, so that we can develop a powerful mind to be able to abandon everything.
Are there underlying tendencies that are asavas?
Underlying tendencies? I have no idea.
Okay.
Underlying tendencies, I don't think. Does anybody know what they are? Huh? Oh, when I read, I sort of think like the habits of the mind, the underlying tendencies, which anything which basically keeps you in samsara. When you understand the Buddha's teachings, there's things that's keeping you here, keeping you reborn, basically the fetters, the five hindrances, greed, hatred and delusion. They're just like words pointing to one thing, or pointing to, you know, just one thing really. You pursue the path, you develop it, you cultivate it. You're generating the path through the practice of meditation. Ajivam, when he teaches here, he always talks about the deep meditations, the jhanas, and then once the jhanas are attained, the mind is powerful, and then you sort of like wipe out all the things that keep you stuck in samsara, all the attachments, all the, you know, underlying tendencies, you can call them, or things that are uprooted. It's just basically just clearing your mind, just freeing your mind. And these are just words that point to the things which are stopping you getting there. And if you talk to Ajahn Brahm, he would say that this path is more of a path of feeling. You feel your way through the path. It's an emotional path. And these are, you know, words that the Buddha used to just describe it in many different ways. But I think he means the same thing. If you read the suttas enough, if you've been a Buddhist enough for a long time, you can understand it's just more or less the same thing. Any more questions? Eddie? Oh, you'll give it to this young man over here. He hasn't asked a question.
All right. I have a question about the emotional path. So, what if someone is a complete psychopath? Would they have trouble following the path because it's an emotional path?
Well, that's a good question. I guess it's how you interpret it. It's when Ajahn Brahm talks about the path of meditation, it's more of a feeling path. You know, You feel the peace, you feel the emotion. But that's just one way of describing it. But if you were to describe it to like a person who's not so emotional, like a psychopath, you can say to them, it's more of a path of stillness, you know, quiet, a letting go where there's no thoughts, where things are blank, really. You're creating more energy, more stillness in the mind.
Do you think like the love and compassion comes out of stillness then?
Yeah, I think so. Because it's like when you become a meditator, you become a lot more stiller, you become more sensible. Like I remember asking Ajahn Brahm, if you can give Buddhism another name, well, what would you give it? He would say, common sense-ism. So you just need a bit of common sense, right? So what happens is when you become still and more peaceful, the loving kindness and compassion, it just comes out when you relate to people. And when you relate to people. So if I were to relate to so-and-so, what would be the best way to relate to them? Should I be like condescending or be bossy, or should I have a sense of friendliness and loving kindness towards them? So when you're practicing or you're becoming still, you want to be able to live, harmoniously with other people. You want to, create like a good feeling between one another, and because of that you can act accordingly. So that's when the metta and the compassion comes out.
Thank you.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Ajahn Santuti, I was thinking of the underlying tendencies. It could be very strong. It takes time, to eradicate the things, and it could take lifetimes too.
Oops. Yeah, it just takes time. One lifetime, two lifetime, doesn't matter. It just takes time. But you can see that they're getting less and less and less. Yeah. I'd like to give the example of like letting go is like when you have when you were younger, you played with the tennis racket and the ball, and it was attached to the pole, and you would hit it. You're like hitting it. It's sort of like a simile for like trying to let go. You hit it, right? The ball goes away, but it comes back to you. You hit it again, and it comes back to you. And sometimes it's like that when we're trying to let go of things, we're trying to calm down our minds. But over the years, when we, when we recondition our minds, we think in a certain way, we find better skills in letting things go. And what starts to happen is when you start to hit this ball on a string, it comes back. But once you get wiser and, throughout your life, you hit the ball, but the string is not there anymore. And then the ball just goes away and it never comes back. And sometimes when it comes to letting go, you can, over time you can start letting go skillfully. So when you let go of stuff, it doesn't come back. Okay. The noble disciple reflects thus, I am not the only one who is subject to illness, not exempt from illness. All beings come and go that pass away and undergo rebirth are subject to illness. None are exempt from illness. As he often reflects on this theme, the path is generated. He pursues this path and develops it and cultivates it. And he does so, the fetters are entirely abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. So that's, that speaks for itself. I'll just go on to the next one. This noble disciple reflects thus, I am not the only one who is subject to death, not exempt from death, all beings that All beings come and go that pass away and undergo rebirth, are subject to death, none are exempt from death. As he often reflects on this theme, the path is generated. He pursues this path and develops it and cultivates it. As he does so, the fetters are entirely and abandoned, and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. Yeah, that's what I like about this. You know, this little saying at the bottom of the paragraph is, you know, once you start pursuing this path, you develop it, you cultivate it. You know, as he does so, it basically means through time, very slowly, the fetters are entirely abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted, which is very nice, I think, because you can all see in your own minds the fetters and the underlying tendencies. And just imagine one day you get to a point when there's nothing there. That would be so awesome. That would be cool. Okay. This noble path reflects thus, I am not the only one who must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable. All beings that come and go, that pass away and undergo rebirth, must be parted and separated from everyone and everything dear and agreeable. As he often reflects on this theme, the path is generated. He pursues this path, develops it, cultivates it. As he does so, the fetters are entirely abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. It's kind of interesting. I was just thinking then, you know, the Buddha here talks about the noble disciple, and then before that he was just talking to people like you and me, basically there are like two outcomes when it comes to contemplating these things. And for this group of the noble disciples, one starts to, you know, generate the path, they cultivate it, and if it's the stream enterer, and the stream enterer starts to cultivate this path and develops it, and he starts to let go of all the defilements. And I remember just now Ajahn Brahm giving a word of the Buddha class, and he basically says that you get your L plates when you become a stream enterer. Wow, like when I heard that, I was like, oh, all this time I'm putting in, I'm not really getting anywhere, not even L plates. But it's like a powerful statement that he's making. Only when you become a stream enterer, you get your L plates, and that when things really start happening. So this is probably what the Buddha is trying to say here when it comes to cultivating the path. But for us, you know, the first part is still very useful. It gives us perspective, gives us meaning to our lives, do what's important. The noble disciple reflects thus, I am not the only one who is the owner of one's karma, the heir of one's karma, who has karma as one's origin, karma as one's relative, karma as one's resort, who will be the heir of whatever karma, good or bad, that one does. All beings that come and go, that pass away, undergo rebirth, are owners of their karma, heirs of their karma, all have karma as their origin, karma as their relative, karma as their resort. All will be heirs of whatever karma, good or bad, they do. As he often reflects on this theme, the path is generated. He pursues this path, develops it, and cultivates it. As he does so, the fetters are entirely abandoned and the underlying tendencies are uprooted. So yeah, the Buddha is just giving instructions to, you know, the noble disciples to reflect upon these things, because he probably knows that they still need that motivation, that reason to, you know, keep on going, to, you know, practice. That's why we all come here, just to get that reminder as Buddhists to you know, refocus our minds. So we come here on the weekend, I see the same faces over the past 3 days. Come here for the weekend so we can, you know, prepare ourselves for the week that's coming up and try to implement, you know, the teachings to our daily lives. So the Buddha's, yeah, that's what the Buddha's, I think the Buddha's trying to do here is trying to give us that reminder. Obvious things, but powerful. Okay, so worldlings subject to illness, old age and death are disgusted by other people who exist in accordance with their nature. If I were to become disgusted with beings who have such a nature, that would be not proper for me, since I too have the same nature. While I was dwelling thus, having known the state without acquisitions, I overcame all intoxications with health, with youth, and with life, having seen security and renunciation. Zeal then arose in me as I clearly saw Nibbana. Now I am incapable of indulging in sensual pleasures, relying on the spiritual life. Never will I turn back. Yeah. Anything anybody wants to talk about?
Nobody asking questions. I just one more. Okay, yeah. Ajahn Satuti, when we talk about the path, you know, the pathway, don't you think it's also, we also have to reflect, you know, on the stages towards enlightenment, you know, the stream entrant, one's return, and all, you know, the stages.
Mm-hmm.
So if you don't, you are only thinking of this life. So it sounds a bit like a, you know.
What's that?
You see what I mean? The sutta here, it talks about the path.
Yeah.
So the path is, you know, the stages towards enlightenment, the four stages.
Yes.
So we have to reflect on that too, you know.
Yes.
Not that we have to, so, I mean, the monks, you can do it within one lifetime, yes, you know. For lay people, we also have to be true to ourselves, to reflect on that too, so that it makes it easier.
Yeah. It's good to think about these things. It gives us a fuller understanding of what Buddhism is about, and the potential of the human mind, where it can go to. Yeah, I don't see why not. But yeah, you can think about it. If you think about it, the thing, anything is like, if you think about it too much, then it becomes a hindrance. But you think about it every now and again, then that's okay.
No, I don't mean that. Sorry. I mean, like, you know, it talks about pathway, you know.
Yeah.
So the pathway, it's the path towards enlightenment.
Yeah.
And then towards enlightenment is the four stages.
Yeah. The path to enlightenment.
Yeah.
Thinking about the path to enlightenment.
Yes, it is the pathway, you know.
Yeah.
In the sutta, I think, you know. So when you talk about pathway, it's good to reflect that it's not only on this life, you know, it goes on to the, you know.
Oh yeah, onto the next life.
Yeah.
And then life after, yeah.
Yeah. The reason why I say this all, when I first joined Buddhism, you say, oh, it's so hard, you know. And they say, oh, it doesn't matter. Once you plant the seed, that's the main thing.
Yeah, that's a good way of looking at it. Because you don't need to put too much pressure on yourself. Yeah. Yeah. Huh? No. Ajahn Chah once said, if you think too much about the Dhamma, your head is going to explode. So be careful. Okay, any more questions? No? Any complaints? I don't know how it went. Hopefully it went well. Okay. Any questions from the internet? No questions. Oh, great. We can We can bow to the Buddha.
Yeah.
Ha ha ha.